Caribou Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of Caribou in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about Caribou Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
The time is 6 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, Portland. This is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Thank you for listening. Joining me in the studio tonight is my good friend Connor Toth. Connor is not only my friend, but also a local Portlander and a low-carbon transportation activist. So today, that may give you an indication that we're going to be discussing transportation issues and how that impacts the working class and working people in general. So, Connor, thank you for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me on today, Michael.
Some big news that really came out just in the last few hours here today mm-hmm. is that our friends to the north in Seattle, the Sound Transit agency up there, just received confirmation that they'll be getting $1.2 billion in light rail funding for a new light rail line to Linwood, which is, I believe, a city to the north of Seattle.
Yeah, it's about 10 miles north of Seattle, and this is huge news because they've been waiting on this grant for a few years now. It's at about 95% design completion for this whole project, and it's a huge $53 billion transit package in the Seattle region. And they weren't sure if they were going to be able to build it without these federal funds, which Trump had been kind of withholding for quite a while right. from the agency.
Yeah, I know it's been kind of just in transit, in the transit world in general, it's been kind of a big question mark whether or not this administration, you know, based on what the rhetoric that's come out of it, whether or not they would support any kind of innovative, non-car-based transportation projects. So this is a great indication. Not only, you know, it's great for the folks in Seattle mm-hmm. And the surrounding areas and the people who have to get to work who are being increasingly pushed out, but also, you know, for other cities and agencies that are looking to do similar projects that are waiting on funds, such as us here in Portland.
Yeah, with that Southwest Design, Southwest Corridor project, which the design also got approved recently. The funding, of course, so we're still quite a few steps off of where Linwood is, but yeah. The design was approved by City Council, which is really huge.
Yeah, so Metro, the City Council, and then I believe the cities of, I mean, not only Portland, but also Tigard mm-hmm. And Tualatin and Washington County all signed off on it, which means that basically we're just kind of waiting for the voters and for funding
yeah.
the project.
Well, and there is still some hope, you know, with this release of these funds here. I mean, for all the ways that I may disagree with President Trump's view on transportation funding, he does have interest in pursuing some type of infrastructure package, and that could be helpful, and it's a good sign if he is releasing some funds already to a rail project.
Yeah, I mean, this could be, you know, releasing funds to this project and a number of other ones around the country could be his crowning achievement on the next installment of Infrastructure Week. You know, we've already had about three of those, it seems like, so yeah. Maybe that would just spur him to actually do something good for a change.
Maybe he'll
that
do
week.
Something with yeah. one of them, yeah.
As opposed to it just being a cover for other controversies.
Yeah.
But yeah, so down here in Portland, just recently, I believe it was just last week, City Council, the Portland City Council here, approved a massive new transportation package called the Central City in Motion Plan. And basically that allocates $36 million towards about 18 different transit, bike, and pedestrian-centric projects mm-hmm. Within the central city yeah. of Portland, which would be downtown and the central east side. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's a huge step forward in trying to alleviate the congestion issues and the general mobility issues within our city. Most of this, and you probably have a lot more information than I do, but it looks like most of this goes towards increasing bike lanes, yeah. Protected bike lanes, mm-hmm. To making, encouraging more people to bike and making it yeah. safer to do so, and building out bus lanes to get buses moving, and to get it, make it more efficient than just sitting in traffic all day,
yeah.
which is currently what a lot of our buses do.
They do. And, they're really making the tough decisions with this particular plan because there's only so much space downtown.
Right.
And there's already limited parking, as many people know. And they're going to eliminate more than 1,000 parking spaces in the downtown region
yeah.
in order to implement this plan. So I think there's going to be a lot of pushback and a lot more to come on this project. Unlike other projects, I think it's really going to get into the mainstream.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like we saw with the street fee a few years ago, when you actually start dealing with people in their curbside, their curb spaces, it definitely gets more people's attention. Okay. Yeah, it looks like they would be eliminating about over 1,000 spaces.
Yeah.
And that's, considering that would leave about 19,000 spaces, 19,328 spaces mm-hmm. in the central city.
Yeah.
That's a significant amount, considering that currently it seems, I may be wrong about this, but mm-hmm. it seems like most people do commute via car to jobs and various other things in the
yeah.
central part of our city. I know that, luckily one of the big things that you would imagine would be a obstacle to this, the Portland Business Alliance, is actually on board with this plan.
And they're traditionally very opposed to any right. plan that restricts auto infrastructure. So I think they're starting to change their perspective as well and recognizing that Portland is a leader in sustainable transportation, and that itself can be a tool for economic development.
Yeah, absolutely. And, there may be a few outlying businesses that will oppose it based on their own individual needs. I know yeah. that some businesses that are on Northeast 7th Avenue and Northeast mm-hmm. and Southeast 7th Avenue
mm-hmm.
That use a lot of that curbside space for loading and stuff like that may complain about this
yeah.
Because they're planning on using Southeast 7th Avenue as a creating protected bike lanes on there,
yeah.
which would eliminate parking spaces. But if the actual Business Alliance, as well as a lot of major business owners in the city, are in favor of it,
mm-hmm.
that definitely probably goes a long way towards getting public support behind it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think a lot of people kind of expected this to come, particularly for the central city plan. Some people have asked why this doesn't address a lot of the inequities in transportation networks in outer Portland.
Right.
And that's because this is paid for by system development charges, which came from all the construction, which I don't know if you've been in the Central East Side recently.
I have.
Yeah.
I have seen it. Yeah.
The studio, and I live just yeah. a couple blocks away from this studio, and the number of developments is really staggering. And I think people were really waiting to see when there would be a payoff, because they're building a lot of these apartments without parking, much
right.
to the chagrin of a lot of the neighbors in the area. I certainly don't mind, but... people were wondering what they were going to do to alleviate the issues and provide other transportation options for these people in these more dense living units.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, if you had your eyes open in the city for the last few years, you definitely noticed that there's been a boom, like you said.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's more cars, more traffic, more people.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of like you mentioned, there's concern about, well, how come all of this is focused on the central part of the city?
Yeah.
And I think part of it definitely has to do with a lot of the congestion if we're talking specifically about buses,
mm-hmm.
which, you have bus lines that run all the way out, into the eastern parts of, Portland and into yeah. Gresham, and then all the way out west. A lot of the choke points that exist for those lines that help move folks who have largely been pushed to the outer reaches of our city
yeah.
get to work downtown, a lot of the choke points are in that central area, crossing mm-hmm. the river, getting into the more congested areas. And
yeah.
that's when the buses really hit traffic and get stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can allow in this part, at least start in this part of the city, and allow the buses to get moving more quickly through the central part of the city and over the river,
yeah.
That will then ripple out to the other areas. And hopefully that will then spur the city and the other areas, that the other cities that the buses run through
mm-hmm.
to start following suit and building bus-exclusive lanes.
Yeah, and it'll be absolutely beneficial to those people in those outlying communities, because as I think we've both seen before, when buses experience congestion, they sometimes bunch up.
Right.
So effectively, instead of the people on the outer edges, instead of waiting 15 minutes for their bus, they're waiting for 30 minutes and then two buses show up.
And, you know, of course, if you're one person, that doesn't help you at all. And then, yeah. Of course, the first bus that shows up is probably packed.
Yeah.
Those people have been waiting forever.
Yep.
And, yeah, I mean, if the idea is to reduce our dependence on cars in the city and to allow people to move, you know, without having to drive, then, I mean, transportation, to me at least, and I would imagine to you, is the main means of doing that, is to build a really robust system that can allow people to successfully get out of their cars. I mean, because one of the things that I think is a major hindrance to people giving up their car in order to bus is that they, you know, if you have to take a bus that, you know, bus trip that either lasts an excessively long time, or if you have to transfer and that transfer time is a long time, you know, if you're going a distance that is about 12, 15 minutes in the car and it takes you 45 minutes to an hour on a bus, you know, even though you may recognize the value of leaving your car and taking the bus, it's still economically and time, you know, time-wise, it just makes no sense to do that.
Yeah, and we shouldn't be punishing people for making decisions that are ultimately better for the region as a whole by producing less, you know, carbon, by producing less pollution, and, you know, by transporting themselves via a safer mode. Because although, you know, people will say all these big buses are dangerous, they actually commit far fewer accidents than an average driver because they're professional compensated drivers.
Right. Like, they go through training. Bus drivers go through training and they have, you know, they are evaluated on how they drive.
Yeah, months of training for a strong, you know, union job.
Absolutely.
It really provides a lot of people in our region with a great job that they can feed their families with, that they can house themselves with, and that they can ultimately choose how to live their lives how they'd like.
Yeah, and you bring up a great point there, that it is, it's a union job. It's a strong, good-paying, stable union job to drive a bus or to drive any sort of transit, public transit vehicle.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the alternative that a lot of people have been floating, there's a lot of people that particularly come from, you know, more of the libertarian side of things or the right of the spectrum.
Yeah.
You often get the idea that we're like, well, no, we just need to have more autonomous vehicles or we need, you know, more Uber and Lyft and ride sharing options like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously there's can be a balance struck between the two, but if you're creating those jobs in to the detriment of bus driving jobs, you're essentially hurting, you're taking away good union jobs for contract working jobs where people are, it's a, you know, you're taking away the proletariat and creating the precariat, you know, people who live precarious lives who don't know if they're going to be able to, if they, you know, their car breaks down or anything like that, those people are then all of a sudden out of a job.
Yeah.
Or they, you know, even if they do get hurt on the job and their car is all right, they may have physical injuries and they don't have health insurance for that.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, they think there's all these worker protection things that have been in place for dozens of years in the United States. And surely if I were hurt at work, someone would take care of me. But that is not the case with these transportation network companies. It's purely contract based.
Yeah. And, you know, then you add on top of that the fact that, I mean, and this is a small thing, but TriMet is, it is a government agency. It's accountable, you know, to a degree to the people. In the city, whereas if you look at Uber or Lyft, or I know that there are other ride sharing companies, although I've never actually seen them. I think I've seen signs for like Wings at the airport. I don't know what that is.
But, I'm not sure either.
But I mean, those companies are not necessarily, besides, you know, to the consumer in some abstract way, they aren't necessarily beholden to us as a population, as to the needs of the city.
Yeah.
And that's evidenced pretty well in the fact that, or pretty clearly in the fact that we've seen traffic spike in the last few years, and it's definitely, you know, it's been proven. There have been studies that have come out that have shown that when you have more people, more ride-sharing vehicles on the road, they, instead of driving to a place and parking, and then you leave your car there and go do what you're going to do, that car drops you off and then becomes more traffic and just cycles all day. And on top of that, it's also been proven that people who there are trips that are done. It's not just simply replacing a trip that you would make in your own car.
Yeah.
It's also adding trips that you might make via another form of mobility, another form of transportation.
Absolutely. And I think it's also worth noting, and I always like to make this point when I talk about these agencies or these companies, is that they are not profitable entities. What they make money off of is speculative investment on your information. They do not make money from driving you around. That's the reason it's so cheap.
Right.
It's cheap because they are losing money operationally. $50 million a year they lose. And they're making their money all via this speculative interest from your information, where you're going, when you're going, and probably why you're going there. If you have a destination listed, they know.
Right.
You know, you don't go to the laser tag arena without going to play laser tag.
They know that they can sell you those sweet laser tag goggles, or I guess it's been a long time. I don't remember exactly what you need for it, but I'd imagine that you have to buy some sort of outfit.
I think they provide you with the best. I wouldn't like to admit how recently I've been.
Do tell. Yeah, I think for me it's probably been at least 15 years, but I could be totally off on that. I may have done it more recently and not remember.
I went for someone's 34th birthday last year.
That is awesome. Kudos to them.
We really showed those 12-year-olds.
That's true. Yeah, you do. Unless you rent the place out, you are competing against children for that.
Always. Yeah, he goes on the cheap night where you get unlimited play for $20.
Oh, that's a good deal.
Yeah.
Is that around here somewhere?
In Milwaukee.
Ah, well, you can take the orange, the light rail line down there.
Yeah, and then walk by some sketchy parking lots.
Oh, that sounds great. But anyways, yeah, just to cycle back to what we were talking about. So not only are these companies, you know, it's basically like the Amazon model, it seems to be, where
yes,
these companies are coming in and, you know, again, it's largely Uber and Lyft, mm-hmm, and they are essentially just trying to dominate the market by underpricing everyone else,
yeah,
getting anyone else out of the market. And particularly what these companies are aiming to do is to get cab drivers and cab companies out of the way. And those tend largely to be more stable unionized positions,
mm-hmm,
where people actually have benefits and work for a company, or if not, they own their own vehicle and they work for themselves.
Yeah,
getting those people out of the way in order to dominate the market of, you know, personal transport.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, presumably once there's no more competition, then they would likely raise the prices, and in the process you transfer people who have good stable jobs, good paying jobs, and put them into that really precarious position of being contract workers for a large tech company based in Silicon Valley.
And they are also actively pursuing autonomous vehicular technology,
right,
and there is the clear end goal there of eliminating all of those jobs as well.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't see how anyone could think that they're moral companies at this point. They are actively hurting our society, and they're growing a monopoly over the industry, you know, the two of them. And the reason why it doesn't pan out in terms of them getting in trouble for any of that is that the prices have stayed low for now.
Right. That's sort of a similar thing with Amazon again.
Yeah.
Where a lot of our laws in this arena are kind of geared towards whether or not a consumer is being hurt.
Yes.
And so as long as you are still providing a favorable condition for the consumer,
yeah,
the laws don't necessarily care whether or not you're doing something bad for other businesses or for your employees. I mean, there's different laws that would care about that, but either way, I mean, so as long as you're providing good, affordable services,
absolutely,
and you're responsive to the needs of your riders, then that's all that really matters in the eye of, you know, of the law.
Yeah, it's a scary spot to be in.
Right.
But we'll see how the next few years, I think, will really be a catalyst for change. I mean, I think they said they provided 91,000 rides a day in the Seattle area. They were recently forced to release their data, and that's competitive with public transportation agencies.
Oh, absolutely.
And this is the early stages of their business model, and no one knows what the ultimate implications of it will be.
And especially, you know, if that's the case in a city like Seattle that is, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, but the only city in this country that in the last year actually saw an uptick in public transit ridership.
They did. They were the only region that saw an increase in public transportation ridership year over year.
Yeah, that's pretty intense. And so, you know, it doesn't bode well for the cities that are already seeing a downtick in public transit usership and ridership. And so hopefully this new plan that the city council is putting forward, the Central City in Motion plan, will actually help to combat this trend towards, you know, continuing to use cars and continuing to use these companies that are not great for the workers and for the environment in general. And just because you mentioned Seattle, I mean, one of the ideas of this plan is that the city of Portland historically jumped out ahead of a lot of other cities in being a sort of a beacon for transit and for alternative planning.
Absolutely,
non-car-centric planning.
Totally become well-known for that.
Yeah, but it's in similar way to our label as a bike city, you know, where we got ahead and then kind of rested on our laurels there.
Absolutely.
The same thing is true with transit in a lot of ways. And currently, you know, a lot of other cities have made bigger leaps ahead of where we are, particularly places like Seattle and Vancouver and BC and Denver. And so, you know, one thing, just a little fact that I pulled out here is that for Seattle, and we just mentioned how they have seen an increase in their ridership, and they put a lot of money into improving their bus systems and building out light rail there. So really improving their transit system. And they've seen over the last, I believe it's over, actually I'm not sure exactly what the time period is for this, but they've seen a creation of 60,000 jobs in the city center, which, you know, cannot directly be attributed to the infrastructure changes. But in that time period where you've seen an increase in jobs in the central part of the city, you've also seen a reduction of about 4,500 people or car trips being made.
Absolutely.
So that's a pretty impressive balancing act to where you have more people working in the center part of the city, but also reducing the amount of cars driving into that area at the same time.
Yeah, no, it's really impressive. And I think a lot of it can be attributed to their more equitable investment in transit infrastructure around the city compared to other regions. So while Portland has an extensive light rail network, you know, still relatively few percentage of the population lives within walking distance of it to actually access those services. Whereas in Seattle, they planned 23 bus rapid transit lines to spread across the whole city. And that was an effort to really promote ridership for everyone rather than just those who are lucky to live near a high capacity transit model like light rail.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit more about that, but that does seem to be kind of a trend, and I mean, we just see it around us, but it's also, it's borne out in the numbers that when you, you know, you build light rail lines, and we see it in a lot of parts of this city, where a light rail line goes in, and that area, I mean, maybe gentrify is the wrong word, but it rejuvenates, or it becomes a higher pricing, a more expensive place to live. And there's a lot of development around it.
Yeah, it intensifies development really immensely. And that's one interesting thing about the bus lines as well, is when you invest in them, it does provide, you know, some economic growth, but it's much less of a sharp increase that really is likely to displace people. It's more of a gradual increase that goes along with better infrastructure.
Yeah. And I mean, if the idea of providing better mass transit, you know, of building a line of a train line, the idea is to, in order is to get people out of their cars and create a way for people to get to work, working people to get to work, then it does seem like that's counterproductive to put in a line that would then displace the people you're trying to provide a service for.
Absolutely.
In favor of people who may, you know, and this, I'm just speculating wildly. I do not have numbers here to back this up, but I would imagine that outside of maybe cities like New York and Boston or some of the major old transit cities, you have a reality that the higher income bracket you're in, you know, the more money you have, the less prone you are to using public transportation.
Oh, absolutely.
Even if it is readily available and right in front of you.
Yeah.
If you live in some fancy new condo building along a streetcar line or a light rail line, you may still not necessarily use that in favor of using a car or a rideshare.
Yeah, you may use it when it's most convenient to you, but that's something that TriMet has had a big notice of lately as well, is that wealthier people will use public transportation for their commutes, but they may not ride it as often as someone who is transit dependent.
Right.
And therefore would use transit all throughout their day to get to the grocery store, to go pick up their kids, to go to the park. Whereas these wealthier residents only choose it when it's most convenient during peak commute hours.
Yeah. And so to really be able to help, to most effectively help working people who are, as we mentioned before, you know, in this city and in other cities, continually being pushed farther and farther out of the central core of the city into more sort of far-flung neighborhoods. To really help those people, it does seem like increasing bus service, putting more bus lines into those areas, and increasing the frequency and a lot of other things that would come with that,
yeah,
is really what would most help working people.
Absolutely.
Versus, you know, one or two shiny new transit projects that are, you know, and don't get me wrong, those are great ideas, and absolutely, more transit is better, but maybe not necessarily the most equitable version of that.
Absolutely not. And I think this is another way that the Seattle region is really leading our the Portland area right now, is because they are building light rail, but instead of building light rail as a replacement for a bus line like we tend to do here in the Portland region, they are building a far superior light rail spine that the buses connect to.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that you can use the extremely efficient, very frequent, it runs every 5 minutes or less in Seattle.
Oh, man.
Yeah, three times as frequent as the TriMet.
Yeah.
and the buses, they upgrade those so that people have great connections to the rail. So you get great transportation in your neighborhood on that local bus line, as well as a connection to a very strong and fast light rail network.
I mean, that seems like the exact answer right there.
Yeah.
Where, yeah, you have spur lines, you have lines that that crisscross, you know, they cross over the light rail line. You have one light rail line that runs out, bus lines that connect to it, that go out into different areas, bring people to that train.
Yes.
You have frequencies high enough that you can then, you know, people, if they have to transfer, it's not a long wait period.
Absolutely.
So that it is an efficient journey, even though you are making a transfer from vehicle to vehicle. That seems like the obvious solution. I know that, you know, one of the major hindrances to that for us in this city is the major choke point of the Steel Bridge.
Yeah.
You can only run a certain number of trains over it per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so that does reduce the capacity, the amount of trains we can have running on line. So that reduce that kneecaps our headways, you know,
absolutely,
if we wanted to increase them.
Yeah.
So that is definitely something that would need to be dealt with in order to create a system like you're discussing. But that does, you know, having the bus lines connect to a spine, a light rail spine, does seem like the obvious solution to making it more equitable and making it more far-reaching for an entire metro area.
And then those who do live along that line are rewarded with much more reliable service as well, because their trains are entirely grade separated, all the new stuff they're building.
Right.
So unlike here, where a train can hit a car and it'll delay the whole system for an hour or more, they're running underground or elevated, so that those things are far less likely to occur.
Yeah, it's all those little things that come together to really, I mean, you know, if, yeah, you have a situation where not more than a certain number of trains can cross the river at a certain time, combined with the fact that you may have delays building up because there was traffic that blocked a train, or you know, any number of other things that happen because the train interacts with the outside world, all that can build up and basically reduces the efficiency of it, and it cuts working people off from being able to use it more effectively, so they're forced into their cars.
Absolutely. And so, you know, at this point, we're considering our own line right now, and I'm curious to hear what you think about this Southwest Corridor line, you know, where it's going, what it's going to be built, the $2 billion price tag.
That's right. I mean, I think that that's an area that absolutely needs to be serviced by more effective transit. It does seem, though, that if they were to choose that same route and just build a bus rapid transit line, you know, secluded lanes for buses, more higher capacity buses running more frequently, that might be a cheaper, more effective, and more resilient method of dealing with the transit need, the desperate transit needs for that entire Southwest area.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, I think it's projected that it would be 2027 at the earliest before trains would be rolling on the Southwest Corridor line.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, at that, we are going to have to call it a night. Connor, thank you so much for joining me. This was a conversation that I would love to continue at some point, but we got the big points. So thank you for being here. Thank you all out there for listening. Again, this is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. If you'd like to talk more about this, you can find me on Twitter at Michael B. Cath. Otherwise, tune in next month on the third Monday of the month from 6 to 6:30, and you will hear us. Have a great night.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, It's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Top Dog Underdog, running Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays through December 1st at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee. Top Dog Underdog tells the story of sibling rivalry between African-American brothers in a turbulent relationship punctuated with dark humor. Their names are Lincoln and Booth. The show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Top Dog Underdog, running Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays through December 1st at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Welcome. You're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. This is Isabel Sinclair here with Jackie Witt, a formerly incarcerated person. Jackie comes from a background of intergenerational incarceration and has managed to overcome these odds by becoming, for example, a certified peer mentor, and is currently partway through an electrical apprenticeship. Jackie is a strong advocate for justice reform.